that fear or awe about what is about to happen, or what actually is happening, can unsettle the mind and can take the mind away from that mental object and stop one entering fully the experience of jhana. That fear is only overcome through experience, through going step by step nearer and nearer to the experience of jhana, and realizing through one's own experience that this is a very powerful state, but a very comfortable state, a very joyful state where there is nothing to fear at all. And when one can overcome that fear, then one can enter the state and enjoy the benefits from that state. The other difficulty or other problem is not fear, but exuberation, the feeling of a wow, at last, here it is. Again, that movement of the mind, that exhilaration, that feeling of great success, will take the mind away from the experience of jhana. The only way to enter this jhana is with this calm, cool mind, where one doesn't interrupt the flow which is tending towards jhana. One doesn't interrupt or say anything or do anything, but one just continues in this inclining of the mind into the mental object, into that which is piti and sukha. Once that piti and sukha is clearly established in the mind, it becomes the main object of first jhana, and it becomes that which holds the mind in first jhana. The mind is satisfied, the mind is content with that peaceful and blissful experience. Now, because perception is based on one's past karma, it is built up of one's past experiences, you may describe this piti and sukha in different ways to yourself. This piti and sukha is a peaceful experience, but very joyful. It's not so much overwhelming, because overwhelming is more this feeling of exhilaration which takes you away from the object. It is more fulfilling, satisfying, arising contentment. In other words, it is a feeling which can sustain itself. The fact that the mind has found this inner contentment, this inner peace, this inner satisfaction, this inner piti sukha, means that one can maintain the awareness there quite comfortably. Even though I say this, that one can maintain the experience quite comfortably, that vitakka and vichara still is operating. That which nudges the attention onto the object, that which maintains it there, is still operating. Only this is the most refined type of vitakka and vichara that exists. The most refined nudging, the most refined maintaining of the attention on piti sukha, that which is peaceful, that which is joyful in the mind. Again, this piti sukha arises because something has been abandoned. This piti sukha is a joy of release. That's why it can first appear as peace, and it can later be developed as happiness. Again, because vitakka and vichara are still operating here, there is still a nudging of the mind, there's still an effort to keep the mind on the mental object, on the piti sukha, even though this is extremely refined, it is not called full samadhi yet. full samadhi or full one-pointedness of mind is only achieved once this vitakka and vichara are no longer necessary. And if one looks at the suttas, that there is in at least one place, if not two, a sort of in between stage between the first and second jhana, where vitakka is no longer necessary. The piti sukha, which is in the mind, is well enough established that one does not need to nudge onto that object anymore. There is just a piti sukha there, but there is still that function of the mind which maintains awareness there, necessary. And this is a sort of between stage which is mentioned sometimes in the suttas. Often it is not mentioned at all, because once the vitakka is not necessarily, very soon afterwards the vichara isn't either. And the piti sukha becomes fully established in the mind, that joyful happiness born of samadhi, of the mind which truly has come to one point. The way one will perceive these two states again depends upon one's past experience. You know, these are the terms which one picks out from one's experience to describe these states. The experience is the same, but the words one uses to label them can be different. In this particular state, the first jhana is a mind which is almost solid, but is just a little bit wobbly on the edges. A piti sukha which is, if you like, vibrating, or if you like, a piti sukha which is a ball with hairs on it, just not quite smooth on the outside, not quite solid, but its edges tend to smooth over into what's adjacent to it. But when one achieves second jhana, the mind is like a solid, hard ball with no edges to it at all. The piti sukha is firmly established in the mind, and is so firmly established that it has a different flavor to it, a different experience to it, a much more refined piti sukha than was there before. And this piti sukha is that piti sukha born of concentration. Here, the mind being solid, the mind not moving, just this one object, one mental object, from moment to moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, not changing in any aspect whatsoever, just a constant state of consciousness where nothing is moving. Because nothing is moving, there is no vitakka and vichara there. Just the experience of still happiness and bliss. From that, the piti sukha, as it were, divides, as if the twins move apart, and the rough part of piti sukha, the disturbing part, which one never knew was disturbing before, falls away. And as it falls away, one is left just with the feeling of happiness, with equanimity. This feeling of happiness with equanimity being the twofold object of the third jhana. In this experience, again, the deeper one goes, the more refined it is, and the harder it is to talk about it. You ask the meditator afterwards, what was it like? And one can just say it was just happiness and equanimity for a long time. A more peaceful, a more quieter, a more tranquil form than was there before. That's why it is this process of samatha, of quietening, calming, going on at each particular stage. And then that happiness, that's why they call it the happy state praised by the Aryans. The happiness itself gives away, and all one is left with is equanimity. Equanimity and pure mindfulness. Sometimes one can ask, is this one state or two states? But it's just one state, just with two aspects, just depends on which you want to look at it from. Just pure equanimity, pure mindfulness in the state of the fourth jhana. And again, a mind which is solid at this point. Now here, this becomes the object of consciousness. It is a mental object, not a physical object. It's an aramana. It's an object of the mind sense, not an object of sight, not an object of sound, not an object of taste, smell or touch. It's an object of mind. Once one knows what these objects of minds are, mind is, what these objects of mind are, not based on the other five senses, one gets a good understanding of what we mean by these mental objects. And this becomes the achievement of fourth jhana, this pure equanimity, pure mindfulness, as the object of consciousness, of the mind consciousness, from moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, without any break, without any interval. And the deeper one goes into calm, usually the longer one can stay there. The more calm a thing is, the more it takes for it to be moved. It's as if one is applying stronger and stronger brakes onto the mind, and in fourth jhana just all the brakes are solidly on, locked. The mind isn't moving at all, and it takes a lot to move that mind. That which eventually moves the mind in each of these states, you may call it the karma which was there before. I like to describe it as the momentum with which one entered that jhana. If one entered it with a lot of momentum, with a lot of energy, not disturbing energy, but the energy of samatha, then one stays for long periods. If the samatha is built on a solid foundation from where that energy can arise, the jhanas will last for long. And again, the deeper the jhana, the longer one will stay. And that will often be despite any wish or desire, because certainly in the second jhana there's no wish or desire can ever enter the mind whatsoever. Even in first jhana it's very hard, but certainly in second, third and fourth, that no intention can really be made within that state. The mind is solid, it's fixed on its mental object. Once an intention arises, one has lost the jhana. And these become the experience of the fourth of the jhanas, successively more peaceful, more profound, more silent states of mind. The Buddha was saying that what you are doing here is calming the body, the inner speech and the mind. You're working with feeling and perception, those two khandhas, and you're calming them, refining them more and more and more. And this calming, this pacifying, this settling is what gives rise to the jhanas. And the result of the jhanas is the happy abiding. The Buddha said there's four types of practice: the happy and the fast, the happy and the slow, the difficult and the fast, and the difficult and the slow. The happy practice, fast and slow, is that which depends on jhanas. This is the happy abiding for a monk. And if a monk does not have experience of those jhanas, he will find himself looking for pleasures eventually in other areas, especially in the five senses. The result of a jhana is that the mind is so satisfied and fulfilled, for a long time afterwards the hindrances are completely still. The mind is satisfied, it's had its fill, and so it does not wish, it does not move towards looking for sensual delights. And it is so content that it is impossible to gain ill will. The mind is bright, it's had energy, and so the third hindrance of tinamida just doesn't come up. And the stillness in jhana persists afterwards, and so the udicca kukkaccha, the restlessness of the mind, will not come up. The kukkaccha will not come up because there's not the slightest bit of remorse. One knows that one has achieved a very profound state, and one has joy, not remorse, and the doubt is not there. One has experienced something which one has read about in the suttas. One has experienced that which the Buddha and the disciples had experienced, and one knows clearly that one has. And this abandons and destroys that doubt about the path of meditation. And so the result is a happy abiding, a clear abiding, an abiding in which the five hindrances are dispersed for a long time, until the effect of that jhana eventually wears off. And that is why that this is a marvelous opportunity on the emergence from the jhana to turn the mind to the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, or to turn the mind onto the Four Noble Truths, or to turn the mind on observing the five khandhas or the six sense bases, or even turning the mind back onto the jhana factors. And this is the opportunity where one gains the powerful insights. One has gained these powerful insights because one has had, or one has developed, the powerful mind. So this is the description of the four jhanas. If you can remember that these four jhanas are established by first establishing virtue, and then by sense restraint, and then by sati and sampajanya, mindfulness and clear awareness, and then by taking the meditation object and developing it in the way described by the Buddha, capturing the meditation object and so till the whole object is clearly in front of you, and then calming it until the kamatana gives way to its corresponding mental image, and then by nudging the mind onto that mental image, by keeping it there using vitakka and vichara, maintaining the attention on that image until the piti sukha emerges, and watching the attention take that as its object, the piti sukha, developing it, absorbing into it, creating the factors of the first jhana, and as that first jhana settles down, to see it settle down and go into the second jhana, maybe the third, and even the fourth. The gradual process of calming the mind into deeper and deeper levels of peace. So that ends this talk on jhanas. I'm sure there may be some things which one either hasn't understood or which one disagrees with, because when one describes the states of mind, they are extremely difficult to put into words, but hopefully that I have explained some of their major characteristics clearly enough, both to give one a sense of direction and also to enable one to recognize these states as they occur and to recognize the states which certainly are not jhanas. Because quite often it seems that people maintain that a particular experience is a jhana when it is not. And so it is good to know the description so one can know the experience. And lastly, hopefully, that just the mention and the description of these states will encourage in each one of us the aspiration to achieve that which other monks, that which the Buddha experienced, so that we can put forth the effort depending on that aspiration and find that we too can experience a jhana. Now, has anyone got any questions or comments about the talk?
At the beginning of anapanasati practice, is it possible to separate vitakka and vichara?
The question is, at the beginning of anapanasati practice, is it possible to separate vitakka and vichara? In my experience, yes. Again, it depends upon the clarity of one's mind. One can, by repeated examination, repeated observing of that which keeps the mind on the object, distinguish two different functions of the mind. That function which pushes the mind onto the object and that function which holds it on. You're asking that is it possible to be able to maintain the awareness on the mental object without vitakka constantly being present there? Yes. Okay, you're saying that you can maintain, or can you maintain one's attention on the mental object without pushing it onto it? There are a couple of points there, that once the attention is reasonably on the mental object and there's a little bit of peace there because the mind isn't moving too far away, it can maybe compared to the monkey who's just holding on to one branch but is still swinging a little. The vitakka and vichara should be noticed in this state and applied or encouraged in order to get closer into that mental object. Again, it is a case where one is being satisfied too quickly, too easily. One should apply a bit of vitakka which pushes the mind deeper in to the object, and the vichara which, when you get deeper in, to hold it deeper in. And you will find then that that which is just mere peace starts to expand and even explode into great joy and happiness.
It seems at that point, if pity doesn't arise naturally or spontaneously, it seems that there's this anticipation, it's like a subliminal anticipation of wanting.
Okay. You're asking that once the mental object is pretty clearly in front of one's mind and one has a feeling of peace, that sometimes the desire for piti sukha can be very strong and act like an anticipation which destroys the quiet of the meditation. Again, this needs to be cured, needs a very refined type of mind which allows the previous like intention to get jhana to work to its fulfillment. And so the anticipation or the desire is not so much for the goal as for that which causes the goal to arise. So one aspires to make the mind peaceful. One aspires to create the causes. And one works to create the causes rather than put one's attention on the goal. Very similar to going on a journey, and instead of thinking of the step you're taking now, just looking way over there for the goal and wondering, when am I going to reach it? So it is putting the attention fully on the cause. At this particular stage, the cause is applying that vitakka and vichara to create the samatha, or the effect of samatha. And you'll notice that when the mind looks at peace, when vitakka and vichara holds peace closer and closer and closer, it begins to realize that peace, this peace, is or has the factors of piti sukha embedded in it. Like peace, if you like, is that feeling of peace is a forerunner of the piti sukha, and the piti sukha is just under the surface of that, because the peace is the sign of freedom from the disturbance, and the piti sukha is the appreciation of that freedom. Well, yes, at each point in these meditations, one needs to have the faculty of wisdom very strong. And that's why that the Buddha once said that anapanasati, or the meditation on the breath, is really suitable for those who've got very strong wisdom. Because at each stage, as either the physical object of the breath, and especially the mental object of the breath, starts to appear, the mind needs to be very wise in order to follow this and to know how to calm it even further, how to be aware of it and what to do with it. And at each stage one develops this wisdom, and the wisdom is mostly developed by seeing what happens with what one does, and by noticing especially these different functions of the mind, like vitakka, like vichara.
Is it possible for piti sukha to arise in physical breath, or does it have to be
nothing? You're asking, is it possible for piti sukha to arise on the physical breath, or does it have to arise on the mental image of the breath? The piti sukha which arises or can arise on the physical breath is of a different order than the piti sukha which arises on the mental image. One is coarse, the other is refined. They may have similar characteristics, but once one has much experience of the piti sukha of just the physical plane, and one has enough experience of the piti sukha of, if you like, the mental plane around the mental objects, one can differentiate their differences and really appreciate for oneself why we say that the piti sukha in jhana is much more refined, much purer, and of a, in the sense of a completely different and higher quality. There's some aspect of it which is the same, but there's another aspect of it which is much, much different. That aspect of it which is the same is the ability to delight the mind.
Would it be possible to get into jhana just with a free attention to the physical breath only?
You're questioning, is it possible to enter jhana through attention on the physical breath alone? In brief, no, it's not. I can imagine though that a person who is watching the physical breath alone has an experience, especially that maybe one of these experiences of whooshing inwards or of quick concentration, where the mental image comes up very quickly, the piti sukha gets very strong, and in a very short time the mind tends to fall in and stay in that piti sukha, which is a mental image. It is unlikely, but I can imagine the process happening. Does that answer your question?
It's more or less impossible.
I wouldn't say it's impossible, I'd say it's unlikely. Especially for a person who is beginning meditation, who doesn't have much experience of what we mean by mental object or mental image. They may even mistake the mental image as being a physical feeling, because the mental image is a very refined thing, and the perception, if it is not very well informed, may not know how to understand it and just think of it as a physical feeling. I can imagine that happening. But with more experience, one will know, or one will be able to distinguish, that this is indeed a mental image, and this mental image is one of the doorways, or the main doorway, into jhana. I've heard that it is possible for some very experienced meditators to bypass the preliminary stages and to arouse that mental image almost at will. And once one knows that mental image well enough, that I can imagine it is possible to arouse that mental image at will and to enter jhana extremely quickly. Just by arousing that mental image, and the piti sukha around that will also rise very quickly and draw the attention in almost immediately.
You have to explain the process. What's the one way with the first jhana? How does he go? Does he ever do the same?
Yes. Now, how does one get from the first to the second to the third, and so forth? I must admit that I am not very competent in doing this, so that here I am going from a very weak experience rather than from anything more solid. It does seem that if one's attitude at the very beginning of the meditation is to quieten the mind as much as possible, then through the strength of that resolve, one will go so far. It's, I suppose, like throwing a ball up the hill. You know, the faster, the more energy one gives it, the higher it will get up the hill. The deeper in the meditation it will go. I say this because in first jhana, it is in a sense possible to make a resolve. You're actually leaving the jhana, but if the resolve is a very soft one, we can just go straight back into it again. So it doesn't really disturb the meditation or the mental image. But in second jhana and above, I cannot see it possible to make any more resolves. So once one has entered the second jhana, there's no way one can decide to enter third or fourth. It either happens or it doesn't, depending on what one was doing before. If you like, the karmic effect of one's resolve, as one entered that state, can push you deeper, or one just stays in second jhana. I have heard that it's possible to not go through the jhanas one by one, but just to determine, say, just to go straight to a third jhana. I'm not really sure whether this is possible or not. As I understand it, that before third jhana lies second jhana, before second jhana lies first jhana, like one room after another in a house, and one can't just jump through the window from outside into the third jhana. But there I may be wrong.
In order to get into the second jhana, one has to withdraw from the first, then to the second, then from the second to the third, one has to withdraw from the second and go into the third.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, sorry, I should repeat that for the tape. You're asking that to get from first jhana to second jhana, do you have to withdraw from that jhana and then go into the second jhana? To go from second to third, you have to withdraw from second and then to go into third? I'm saying not necessarily. One can certainly just from the first jhana just to, if you like, settle into the second jhana, from the second jhana to settle down into the third jhana, from third into the fourth jhana. But the problem here is that one has not the ability, once in second jhana, to formulate a resolution or to formulate anything which one can steer one into the deeper jhanas. That if one does travel in that way, it is because that if you like, one is, when one moves through the door into a particular room, the momentum carries you through that room into the next room.
In that same way, in the same way, skipping jhanas, what's it called? Someone who just goes very quickly through the room, going so quickly through them.
You're asking, is it possible for a person to go quickly through the jhanas? Yes, and so it appears they're dropping into a very deep jhana. Yeah, I think this is what I was saying before, that it is possible if one has enough momentum to go from a first to into the second, into the third, and into the fourth. What I am trying to make it clear that in the second and the third there's no means of propulsion. It seems that way, yes, that one will exit from the jhana and reflect on it afterwards. Sorry, for the tape. You were saying that according to the suttas, it seems that having experienced one jhana, one appreciates that there are coarse aspects of these jhana, ingredients of these jhanas, and so one abandons those to go into a deeper jhana. How I would understand this is that, say, having experienced first jhana, and the mind which is satisfied with the piti sukha of first jhana, having emerged from that jhana, would understand that maybe there is something deeper. Would understand that the mind isn't concentrated yet, there are still some fuzzy edges on the mind, and so would make another attempt to enter a quieter state, but I would still maintain they have to go through that first room until they go to the second room, and they enter that first room with the intent not to stay there but to go a bit deeper. You're asking, so you come to Upachara Samadhi and then you go somewhere else. I think you know my views on Upachara Samadhi, that it was something never mentioned by the Buddha, and so I doubt its validity. If there is anything which is called Upachara Samadhi, it will be that which precedes the first jhana. And doubt very much, and doesn't agree with my experience, that there is anything like an Upachara Samadhi, a different one for each jhana. there's only that which precedes the first jhana, which may reasonably be called upachara samadhi, although the Buddha never mentioned that. So if anything, that which is just before second jhana, that which is like the upachara to second jhana, is first jhana. That which is the upachara to third jhana is second jhana. And that which is the upachara to fourth is third. Are there any more questions on this subject? I will maybe mention just one last thing here, that when talking of many jhanas, it does miss an important point, and that is that one should have the aspiration to attain first jhana, first of all, and to know that very well, first of all, and to have skill in entering that, first of all, and then from there to develop the second jhanas. And then when one has full experience of the second jhana, one knows it well, and one knows the way in and the way out, then to develop the third jhana, and so forth. Again, this methodical practice in Buddhism is the quickest way. And that methodical practice does not start with entering jhana, it starts right back with virtue, with sense restraint, with satisampajanya, with the burning of the hindrances, with watching whether a breath is long or short, with watching a whole breath, with arousing the mental image, with sustaining the awareness on that mental image, with the arousing of piti sukha. At each stage, be fully methodical, and make sure that you have the preliminary stage conquered, well known, before you proceed to a further stage. It may happen sometimes that through your skill, through the causes which give rise to these states, that you are able just to go very deep in your meditation. That is fine. Enjoy that. Learn from it, but don't make that a habit of always expecting that to occur. As far as the jhanas are concerned, really make the first jhana well known, and then the second jhana, and then the third jhana.